Hello, and welcome back to Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. Sort of. I'm your host, Larissa, and in this episode, we'll take a look at the social class that has influenced the history of Ukraine for millennia. But before we begin, let's do the intro, shall we? I may swear in this episode, and if you are listening on a podcast addict or Apple Podcasts, please leave a review or just rate it. You can also find us on a number of streaming sites, including but not limited to Spotify, Google Podcasts, Breaker, and of course the website wanderingtheedge.net, where you could check out any of the previous episodes and sources. Now, normally, I would be all excited about giving you some advice about going to some museum or restaurant in Ukraine. But I can't. Now, can I? Because Russia invaded, and it's not safe to go to Ukraine at this time. But I will actually give you a place to go to in Canada. So, if you're ever near Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, it's a prairie province in the west of Canada, and want to go for a drive 25 minutes east, you'll hit the Ukrainian Cultural Heritage Village. And why am I including this in this episode? Because we'll be talking about peasantry today. And peasantry means village, and since I can't point you to a Ukrainian museum, then let's take a look at the museum dedicated to the Ukrainian Canadians. The Ukrainian Cultural Heritage Village Society was founded in 1971 to create a museum dedicated to the Ukrainian settlement of Alberta. They bought some land and then bought some old buildings and moved them over. Right now, there's more than 40 buildings, and they have created a small village showcasing the history of rural Ukrainian Canadians. I am still, by the way, sick, so therefore you get this wonderful nasally voice today. Now, one of the buildings that is featured here is a burde, which is like a dugout that many new settlers created and lived in while clearing the land, plotting crops, and building a more permanent home. The village also has a barn where travelers kept their horses, the Vostok hardware store from the 1930s, both a Greek Catholic and Orthodox church, the Demchuk blacksmith from the 1920s, a grain elevator that was used to sell farmers' grain, and an Alberta provincial police and a post station built in 1913. The museum also has an old-fashioned railway station from Belize, I don't know how to say that name, that also has a telegraph office and freight shed. There's also the Hilliard Hotel built in 1928 and opened by Mike Zenko and Peter Klushak. I believe it's even still functioning as the restaurant of the museum. There's also a two-room school from the village of Morecombe, built in 1929, and recreates how many young Ukrainians were taught when they first arrived in Canada. Honestly, from the website, the place looks so cool, and they also give you guided tours and like do stuff with you, like cooking and making butter, like hands-on-y stuff. Honestly, I'm not really sure, but just go and check it out for yourself if you can. I'm almost 100% sure it's the only open-air museum dedicated to Ukrainians outside of Ukraine. And if you're around Alberta, the address to this place is 195041 Highway 16 East, Lamont County. And why did this place choose rural life as a way to recreate Ukrainian history? Because farming and the land were and are super important to everything Ukrainian.
Ukrainian culture is fascinating, isn't it? The food, the music, the dance, the food, the clothing, the art. Did I mention the food? And especially the history. It's something that doesn't get the attention it deserves. Something else that doesn't get enough attention in our culture is the history of the Eastern Front of the Second World War, a war fought largely on Ukrainian soil, a war that swallowed up tens of millions of people in many countries. Battles that dwarfed D-Day and the Battle of the Bulge. A war that redrew the world's borders. And a war that echoes in Ukraine right now. I'm Scott Bray, author, honorary Ukrainian, and podcaster of Beyond Barbarossa, first English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. Every episode I go deep into the events as they unfolded 8 decades ago. Regularly, guests join to share their expert knowledge and reflections on the war. So, if you're interested in learning more about history, won't you join me for this in-depth tour of the biggest part of the war that shaped the world we inhabit today? You can find Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting platform. And since you're listening to Wandering the Edge, I know you can spell Barbarossa.
Before we delve into the history of Ukrainian peasantry, though, I have to tell you that modern-day Ukraine consists of 58% arable land among their fertile plains, or what we call the steppes, and plateaus. The country sits along the Eurasian steppe, and its soil can be divided into three types. A sandy, hodzolized soil, which is a chestnut salinized soil, and about two-thirds of the country's surface is this extremely fertile Ukrainian black earth, officially called Chernozems, which is literally black earth in Ukrainian. It is also the same soil that can be found in the Canadian steppes. It is because of this that the country is called a breadbasket. The black earth is so fertile because of its percentage of humus, phosphorus, and ammonia compounds. The soil was so good that there was a rumor that the German Nazis actually transported it back into Germany on train wagons during the Second World War. This rumor was false, by the way. They did not. But there was a complete ban on the sale of agricultural land in Ukraine until 2020, and this led to a black market for Ukrainian soil. You can legally transport and trade it, but not actually sell the damn thing. Weird, I know, but I don't know. What are you going to do? So soil has been super important to Ukrainian history, as the majority of the population lived off that land. Now, the Ukrainian peasantry has made up the majority of the Ukrainian population for, like, ever. Once the tribes started to settle on the land and began to plant crops, they quickly realized that Ukrainian land was pretty damn good and grew anything and everything. And so an agrarian society began. And the peasants were Ukraine's primary social strata until the 1930s, and because of this, it had a very stable way of life and a conservative attitude toward traditions, language, and faith. Because of this, it fostered national ethnic characteristics, some of which were from pagan and even older times, like, for example, the pisanka, or Ukrainian Easter egg, or Ukrainian embroidery, or vyshivanka. Once the Kievan Rus Empire arose, it replaced the tribal social structures among the peasants with relatively autonomous settlement groups, where they worked together to cultivate the land. There was also categories of peasants now. Smeds, who were either entirely free or dependent. The smed was a free peasant who eventually turned into a serf centuries onward. So the free smeds were the largest group and enjoyed the rights of free people, while the dependent smeds lived on princely and boyar lands, paid rents primarily in kind, and were basically like owned by the princely ranks. However, during this period in time, they weren't actually slaves. They could become indentured laborers, but the status was temporary, and once their debts were paid off, they were free again. Now, the social contract in this situation was that the princes and nobles were also charged with protecting the peasantry. This situation existed well until the Mongol invasions began in 1240, and then in the 14th century when the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth took over and the peasants' rights were restricted and their rents increased. Eventually, serfdom prevailed at a time when it was dying out in Western Europe, and in the 15th century, land was divided up into estates called fylvarok, and peasants had to labor on the landlord's land. And while there were numerous rebellions at that time, they were largely left without any recourse until the Union of Lublin in 1569, when the Ukrainians were encouraged by the Polish crown to start settling in the southwestern and eastern Ukrainian territories. And while people obviously didn't want to leave their land, they did because their burdens in the east were a lot less than those in the west. And while peasants in Halychyna in western Ukraine owed 4 to 5 days of labor, in Volyn and Kyiv, it was only 2 to 3 days, while even further eastward in Left Bank Ukraine, they only paid their rent with money. Now, because Ukrainians had a free will and such, and some ran the fuck away from this absolute shittiness and headed to the southern steppes and the Sloboda region of Ukraine. And there they formed the Cossacks, which have become such immense figures of our Ukrainian consciousness. And for more on them, you can listen to episode 12. And although serfdom was abolished in the Hetman state, the Cossack nobility, or Staryshna, began reimposing labor and other rents on their rank-and-file Cossacks. And so tensions began among the Cossacks themselves, which also made it so much easier for the Russian intervention among the Cossack rank-and-file. This Russian intervention among the Cossack, this all would also allow Russian imperialism to slide itself into the Ukrainian peasantry. But that's in eastern Ukraine. In the west, when it came under Austrian rule in 1772, during the first partition of Poland between Russia and Austria, the peasants' position actually improved, especially under the reforms of Empress Maria Theresa and Emperor Joseph II. They limited the peasants' free labor to 3 days a week, made peasants legal owners of some of their land, restricted the rights of nobles to inflict corporal punishment, and even allowed peasants to lodge formal complaints. Serfdom was officially abolished after the revolutions of 1848, or the Springtime of Nations, where democratic and liberal revolutions swept through Europe. However, even though serfdom was abolished, land was an issue in Western Ukraine, and this was because the size of their plots were reduced by the nobility before serfdom was abolished, and because Ukrainians divided up their land among all their children and not giving land to only the eldest child. And so the plots of land kept on shrinking, and the peasantry became land-hungry. That's also why you had so many Western Ukrainians emigrating to North America around the late 1800s, since there just wasn't enough land for them. The Austrians also introduced compulsory education, and this, along with their own efforts, increased the Western Ukrainian national movement, which encompassed the Ukrainian peasantry. And as the flow of peasants to and from the villages and towns increased, so too did the national consciousness of Ukrainians. There was also an increased proactivity of the national conscious movement, especially centered around the Prosvita Society, which I will have to dedicate a separate episode to since it's stupidly important in the history of spreading Ukrainian national consciousness. Now, in the 18th century in Russia was when Catherine the Great's great reformer status came about. Even though she really wasn't. The first great political sort of manifesto that Catherine issued after she took over as empress was the Manifesto of 1763, which basically allowed foreign settlers into Russia. So the great German settlers of the Volga region began because of this change. But while these new settlers could come into the Russian Empire, it was a bit confusing as to where exactly they could settle, because who knew who owned what land? The manifesto also undefined the status of serfs working on the land. Were they free to work the land on their own? Did they belong to the nobility? Or were they a gentry all on their own? In 1765, the General Land Survey, which was originally ordered in 1752, was finally completed, and landlords were recognized as owners of their estates without any actual proof of ownership. But again, what do you do with the serfs? And because a general theory that if you give peasants title to their own land, they would lose it quickly and find themselves destitute, it was only natural and very good for the peasants if the Russian nobles owned the serfs and gave them a guideline on how to work and live. Because, you know, without the nobles, the peasants would just become poor and die. And so, in 1785, Catherine issued the Charter for the Rights, Freedoms, and Privileges of the Noble Russian Gentry. And while this guaranteed those gentry their rights to life, personal liberty, and properties, it also gave them their rights over their serfs, as they were directly tied to the land and thus private property of the landlords. Now, around this time in 1783, Catherine reinstated serfdom in Left Bank Ukraine and Svoboda, so basically eastern Ukraine. She managed to conquer southern Ukraine, while at the same time dismantled the vestiges of Cossack authority, destroyed the Zaporizhian siege, and then began resettling large parts of Ukraine with those foreign settlers, who basically destroyed the bad elements and bring in, so basically destroyed like the bad elements and bring in those good German elements, since she herself was German. And so those Ukrainians who fled east to get freedom from serfdom, and now had a strong attachment to their land and their freedom, were now placed under a foreign rule which enforced serfdom. It was this time that really began this whole Russification of Ukraine, in a very modern sense of what we believe Russia is. You wanted to rise up in the empire structure? Well, you would have to be Russian in identity. You wanted to come out of the peasantry? Well, again, you best learn how to be Russian. This small Russian or little Russian mentality began to be implemented because while the peasantry weren't officially citizens, they were still part of your empire. During this entire time, peasants who were serfs could be tried, exiled, sent to the army, or subjected to corporal punishment by their landowners. They couldn't marry without their permission, entire families could be sold off, and the amount of work the serfs did were set by the landowner. Was this all peasantry? No. Some were freer than others, especially those in southern Ukraine, as they came into the system much later. However, this system of serfdom really fucked up the economic and social development of the Russian Empire, which became very clear when they lost during the Crimean War of 1856, of which you can listen more about on the History Extra podcast that has several episodes about the war. Anyway, it was 1861 that serfdom officially ended in Russia during the emancipation reform that freed serfs from private estates and of domestic serfs. If you worked the land, you had the ability to buy it from the landlords. Now, with so many free serfs, there was also came the 1864 Zemstvo reform, which basically created a sort of locally elected self-government that brought together large landowners, small landowners, including the clergy, wealthy townsmen, so probably artisans and such, less wealthy urban classes, and the peasants. Weirdly, this system only came into right-bank Ukraine in the early 1900s because they were terrified of the influence of Poland. Anyway, during the 1800s is when this Ukrainian identity really began to come into the forefront. And it was led by this new Ukrainian intelligentsia that was coming out of the landowning gentry. Why was this? Because when this new landowning system came about, landowning in itself also changed. Gone was the time of absolute rule, and now landowning actually meant working. So a new social type of real landowners began to be formed as they lived on their estates, visited their rural workers, and wrote articles about their economic nature. They began to interact with their local population and began to write down agricultural economic statistics, like, for example, the history of bread making, cattle breeding, beekeeping, the history of crafts and trade, or breeding of silkworms or yarn and like other stuff. Nobles now began to look back upon their origins and started to think a bit differently than their Moscow brethren. But with more peasants and not so much land, or well, not so much land that was available because who could actually afford to buy land from the peasantry, many Ukrainians began looking outward and moved west and east. And 1.6 million Ukrainian peasants emigrated into the Russian Far East between 1896 and 1914, for example. Those that stayed began to take from the gentry landownings, cutting wood from the landlords' forests, grazing on the gentry meadows, burning estates, and some attacking the gentry itself. Riots rose against them, and populists and revolutionaries supported their actions. All of this came to a head in 1905, during the First Russian Revolution, in which the defeat during the Russo-Japanese War, forced Russification of ethnic and national minorities, agrarian problems, while peasants are free, they can't actually buy land, so they remain a pseudo-serf, and basically a screwed-up economic situation, led to open revolt against the Tsar, which ended up with establishing a state Duma, a multi-party system, and a constitution. But that wasn't enough, and the empire fell apart during the First World War. Now, the 1905 revolution was primarily a peasant revolution because agrarian problems was its main cause, and the peasantry was the main driver of this revolution. Little peasant republics began to spring up, for example, in the Suma district, who was led by the so-called Peasant Union. This Suma Republic initiated strikes, mobilized people for propaganda campaigns, created new courts, and taxed landowners. The Lyubotin Republic in the Kharkiv Oblast only lasted for 9 days, after 120 people were killed and wounded by the army advance, but it existed. as did several other peasant republics that existed in the Svoboda region, so like present-day Kharkiv and parts of the Sumy, Donetsk, and Luhansk oblasts. But they were short-lived, but they popped up everywhere, and they proved that there was a possibility of destroying the existing order. It was also at the turn of the century that Ukrainian mentality began to change also. It became distinctively linked to personal privacy and the right to individual ethnic development. It also placed land as the most highest value, and these values were actually passed down from one generation to another. Their mentality was connected to the land, was increasingly strained with the Russian influence and the arbitrariness and arrogance of Tsarist officials. This began to lead to more and more frustration against the empire, which in turn ended up with peasant uprisings from all the way from Kharkiv to Poltava. However, even after the 1905 revolution, the state's perspective of Ukrainian peasants didn't change, and they continued to view them as their, you know, little Russian tribe. Before another big revolution could take place, a world war broke out, and the Russian Imperial Army needed men to fight their war. And who was the majority of non-commissioned officers? That's right, the fucking peasantry. It was also these Ukrainian peasants who later would fight for Ukrainian independence in the various military structures that existed from 1917 to 1921. However, many found their first taste of warfare in the Russian army, and most were noted for their certain characteristics. Nikifor, and by the way, I've always liked that name, Nikifor Avramenko, a soldier in revolution, noted that, quote, Ukrainians constituted the predominant percentage among the non-commissioned officers, cavalry, and guard. They were known by their discipline and duty, end quote. Alexander Udovichenko also recalled that, quote, Ukrainian soldier was always distinguished by his discipline, higher level of development, and initiative. Thus, almost 40% of lower commanding positions were taken by Ukrainians, end quote. These people would be instrumental as leaders of the peasants' armed resistance during the Revolutionary Wars and afterward. Their ability to fight was shown during the Kerensky Offensive of June-July 1917, to the point that the 34th Army Corps was actually renamed to the 1st Ukrainian Corps during the period of nationalization of military units. Before this, nationalities were mixed and even simple communication was difficult, which would lead one to assume that maybe placing people with the same language in the same unit might be a benefit, but what do I know about this stuff? Anyway, the Kerensky Offensive ultimately failed, and the Russians had to ultimately fall back toward the other side of the Zbruch River, which would later be the border between Poland and the Soviet Union, by the way. But, you know, at least it showed Ukrainians can fight well. Even if we were fighting on our own territory and against our own brothers, but that's for another episode. Now, the war ended, and the War of Independence failed. One of the reasons it failed was because it never gave a concrete policy as to agrarian reform, even though they might have believed in complete emancipation, but they didn't, like, actively promote any policy that would bring in a majority of Ukrainian peasantry. Obviously, because of this lack of agrarian reform, the peasants rebelled and then moved toward the Soviet side as they promised them freedom to do anything and everything. And so slogans came out as everything is allowed and rob what is already robbed to attract more peasants to the Red Army side. And while they didn't form the majority in the Red Army, they nevertheless simmered their support of Ukrainian independence. And so we have this stupid Soviet Union come into play on the majority of Ukrainian territory. Ukrainian peasants in Poland suffered through what others in the 1930s went through, mainly the Great Depression, but also Polish colonial policies that limited the amount of land they could buy. But there wasn't a state-sponsored policy set against the peasantry in Poland, since the majority of their population was actually peasants who also suffered from the Great Depression. Their state-sponsored policies against minorities, on the other hand, really drove Ukrainian nationalism in Western Ukraine. In the East, the state viewed peasantry in a very different light. The new Marxist-Leninist ideology viewed peasants in a sort of dual psychology. For on the one hand, a peasant was seen as a worker, as he worked the land. While on the other hand, a peasant was also a speculator because he sells his products on the market. The Bolshevik leaders, though, believed that the peasants were not proletarians, as they were not backward and as they were more apparently backward and archaic. And so Lenin said this, quote, The interests of these two classes are different. The small farmer does not want what the worker wants. We know that not only an agreement with the peasantry can save the socialist revolution in Russia, end quote. And so the state wanted to control something that could potentially harm them. And so they began to control what the peasants could or could not do. And this began in the 1920s under Lenin. The local Soviet authorities understood that the peasantry was to be controlled and so didn't really do anything with their administrative functions, even stuff they promised to do, like distribute land among the peasantry, which was like one of the main reasons why the peasantry was drawn to the Soviets. They also began to instigate their militant atheism among the peasantry, which also didn't bode well for them, seeing as the priests and the church were an important element in the rural countryside. Some peasants joined the ranks of those staunch atheists, but the majority kept their beliefs either in secret or under state-sanctioned realities. And so there were more and more peasant rebellions that broke out before Soviet power officially consolidated in the 1920s. In 1921, the Soviet regime announced a higher demand for grain from the peasants, but there was also a severe drought, which destroyed the harvest. And so a famine happened. At the same time, there were about 40,000 partisans in Ukraine, and by September 1922, 200 leaders and 10,000 men surrendered after the Bolsheviks declared an amnesty. Then the Bolsheviks began to forcibly liquidate the peasant partisans. From April to May 1921, they apparently killed 5,000 and captured 4,200 prisoners and destroyed 28 bands. By the end of the year, the rebellions were forcibly ended. But that year also showed that the Ukrainians weren't exactly thrilled with the Bolsheviks. And so Lenin announced his new economic plan, which was basically a truce with the peasantry, as it would end unpaid expropriations and establish taxes, after which peasants could sell their products. Peasants were then allowed to lease land or equipment or even hire labor. The cooperative movement expanded. Agricultural production also raised to its pre-war levels. People getting fucking paid for their work was actually a good thing for the Soviet fucking economy. Obviously, the government taxed those pesky pro-independent movements who also couldn't be part of the cooperative movement or be elected into the village councils. But things began to be normal. But then came Stalin. And he did not like Ukrainians, nor did he like Lenin's new economic policy, and threw that shit out and introduced strict economic planning. He also really liked killing a whole range of people, including those he imagined were traitors. And so those pesky kulaks, or well-off peasants, became class enemies, and millions of them were deported between 1930 and 1931. That wasn't enough, now was it? He needed to know everything that those damn peasants were doing, because remember, they weren't purely proletarian, nor were they workers. So what better way to control this population than through fucking collective farms? And so mass collectivization began, which brought all agriculture under state control. Never mind that most of those responsible for agriculture in those years knew nothing about agriculture. I mean, what's the worst that can happen, right? Well, what else could make it even harder to live? Requisition quotas, which began in 1930, did decrease because, well, dead people can't collect the harvest, but they were still high for people that were dying of hunger. What made it even worse was that because people couldn't bring in enough grain, their reserves were taken up. You know, the grain seed set aside for next year or for emergencies. If that wasn't enough, then there was the law of the spiklets, which criminalized something called gleaning, which is when you collect any leftover crops from your fields after the harvest or picking up any crop that isn't sellable. But then, because you want these people to sit where they are and not move, because if they move out, they won't be able to harvest that state-owned fields, well, then you not only produce a blacklist system in which whole villages and districts were sanctioned and blockaded and thus completely starved to death, but you also restrict any and all movement. You close the borders. Any and all information sharing is banned, and you deny, deny, deny. Why send aid when there isn't a problem? Oh, those starving people that are dying while walking along a sidewalk? They're just tired and lying down to take a nap. Oh, and while we're at it, see, we have no problems with a famine. We're exporting enough grain to feed like 5 million people. And so the Holodomor took the lives of millions of Ukrainians in 1932 to 1933. The exact number will never be known because Stalin didn't like censuses. Because if you had censuses, then you would know how many people died between a specific amount of time. So there was one done in 1926 and another in 1937. The lowest estimates are somewhere around the 3 million mark, while the highest is around 10 million. But why focus on Ukrainian peasantry in Stalin's fanatic, addled mind? And Stalin may have been organized, but he was a shit manager who didn't understand shit. And no, he didn't win the war. He almost lost it until he realized his generals probably knew a lot better, which was basically the opposite of Hitler. But that's beyond the point. I just really don't like Stalin. Anyway, why was he so obsessed with destroying the Ukrainian peasantry? Well, first, because he understood that they were the bearers of Ukraine's consciousness and soul. But also that they, given the choice, would always choose free market agricultural economy over collectivization, because collectivization, much like communism, works in theory but doesn't work in practice. Anyway, Ivan Lysiak-Rudnitsky, in his article from 1956, explained it best, quote, "The Ukrainian peasantry's mass resistance to collectivization threatened to undo Stalin's ambitious economic plans. This was the reason behind Stalin's wrath and vengefulness vis-a-vis Ukraine, and it coincided with the feelings of resentment among Russian officials who were offended by the Ukrainians' insolence. Stalin and the Soviet Russian bureaucracy, of which he was the head, decided to teach the hoholes some sense. The losses that Ukraine endured as a result of Stalin's policies were horrific," end quote. And so Ukrainian peasants now had to accept the rules of the Russian collective farmers, who were much more accustomed to communal farming since they did it for so much longer. You wanted to eat, you joined the collective farm. That was basically the simple fact of it. And with this forced acceptance of Soviet communism came a change in the mentality of Ukrainians in general, and thus the lasting shitty impact of Russian imperialism wrapped in a red shawl. Now, this strict collectivism was in place until the disaster of the Second World War, after which each village household could actually have a small private plot around its house, which could then actually feed the family, but the products could also be sold to other villagers and even in the city. But the small plot of land was also supposed to supply the government with milk, meat, and taxes, so it was a controlled acceptance. Khrushchev eventually increased the collective farm's pay, allowed them to move, and even gave them small retirement benefits. But this blossoming of rights didn't last long because by the 1980s, the collective farm system could no longer feed the population, mainly because this whole new generation of peasants raised in the collective farm system turned out to be incredibly shitty at actual productive labor. And so those small plots of land that their parents maintained and grew productively was basically all lost. It was this and the fact that people began moving from the village into the cities, and so the village began to age. And with independence came an even greater drain from the village. And while the village was filled with babushkas, it still held some draw for various generations. How many Ukrainians will go from the city into the village during the summers to help with the planting or the harvest, or actively look into getting some small plots of land around their multi-storied apartment blocks? I did. Almost every summer, we went back to the home village, and if the grain was set to be harvested, we would be shoveling that grain seed into bags and storing them in a barn. You helped with the farm, even if it was your summer vacation. Now, I also wholeheartedly will testify to the fact that I suck with anything that grows. None of my plants last long. But my husband, the man born and raised in the city of Zaporizhia, can grow anything. I think it's honestly due to that good old peasant blood that runs through his veins. We're not too sure if any of his family died during the Holodomor. It's more likely a possibility. But what his peasant ancestors left him is his love for the earth. For all of us Ukrainians have some desire to be on our own homeland, whether it's something you can easily ignore or it's such a pull that you can't ignore. Because it's our land that has made us who we are. And it's our land that we will defend until the last. And now because Russia has decided to invade Ukraine, we need help. Please donate to any humanitarian aid relief you can. I've also posted on my website some suggestions. Please remember to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at WanderEdUkraine. Check out our website, wanderingtheedge.net, for source information and other interesting extras. And if you're listening to me on Apple Podcasts or Podcast Addict, please rate and review and leave a comment about anything, even any weird historical tidbit you have about your culture and peoples. And hopefully the next time you listen, I will not be sick. And if you're listening on all the other streaming sites, thank you very much. And as always, happy wanderings, my friends, and Slava Ukraini, i Heroyam Slava.